From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Life tastes good. That's Coke's new theme. It's also why Colombian Coca-Cola bottlers are suing the U.S.-based multinational for the killing and intimidation of union leaders. And the U.S. stands alone against treaties on global warming, a ban on biological weapons, and stopping the illegal trade in small arms. While politicians and environmentalists argue over Alaskan oil, the real action is in the Gulf of Mexico, where floating rigs are headed for deep water. We'll have a debate on oil and water. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Members of a White House Social Security Reform Commission yesterday defended their work against a firestorm of criticism that the panel is exaggerating the retirement program's financial problems in order to promote the privatization of Social Security. Democrats, labor unions, and senior citizens groups opposed to privatizing Social Security have launched a grassroots effort against the commission, which they say is stacked in favor of private accounts, an idea that President Bush promised to pursue during his election campaign last year. Not a single member of Bush's panel on Social Security opposes privatization. The panel will issue its final recommendations later this year. This news from Huntsville, Texas. A death row prisoner has won a stay of execution as part of a ruling that will allow the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to consider its first appeal under a law allowing DNA testing. Richard Kutzner, an air conditioning repairman, had been scheduled to die by injection 6 o'clock today. The appeals court issued the stay last night. North Carolina is poised to become the 18th state to ban executions of the mentally retarded after lawmakers approved a new law yesterday. The law would define as mentally retarded anyone whose IQ is recorded at 70 or lower before the age of 18. The bill was sent to Governor Mike Easley, who's not expected to oppose the measure, which passed with overwhelming support in both Democratic-controlled houses of the North Carolina legislature. Dr. James Scott Pendergraf, the Florida abortion provider who was convicted of extortion by a nearly all-white jury in Florida, lost his bid to remain free on bond while appealing his conviction. He's expected to report to prison today. Pendergraf's supporters argue that the African-American gynecologist is being targeted for providing abortion services in Ocala, a community known for its fierce anti-abortion protests. Tracy Stern is with Refuse and Resist in Atlanta. She's been following the trial.
Yes, I just wanted to say that this is really outrageous that they have denied his bond pending his appeal, because usually those that are sent to prison while they're appealing are usually because they want to stop illegal activities. However, based on this decision, what they're trying to stop is Dr. Pendergraf from performing his abortion.
Tracy Stern with Refuse and Resist in Atlanta. Secretary of State Colin Powell returned to Vietnam yesterday for the first time since he concluded his second tour as a soldier fighting there three decades ago. Powell, the most senior U.S. official who fought in the war to visit Vietnam, was to attend a meeting of the regional ASEAN group, but will also meet U.S. officials trying to find remains of U.S. war veterans still missing in action. But Powell has no plans to visit the village of My Lai, where U.S. forces slaughtered more than 400 women and children in March of 1968. Powell has been accused of covering up the massacre and stonewalling an investigation when he was an Army operations officer. Survivors of the massacre expressed outrage when Powell said upon arriving in Vietnam that, quote, "there are no ghosts within me that need exorcism." No U.S. official has ever offered an apology for My Lai or for the more than 2 million Vietnamese people killed by U.S. forces during the war. Greenpeace protesters in England have blockaded an Esso fuel distribution center in a demonstration over global warming. About 50 people, including five dressed as tigers, entered the site at Purfleet, Essex, in the early hours this morning. Esso tankers were blocked at the depot entrance by two customized shipping containers bolted to the road. A Greenpeace spokesperson said two volunteers were chained inside each container. Greenpeace says lobbying by Esso has contributed to President George Bush's refusal to abide by the Kyoto Agreement on climate change. And tens of thousands of people, many shouting, "Killers, killers," protested throughout Italy yesterday against the use of police force that left one person dead and more than 230 injured at the G8 summit in Genoa. There were no immediate reports of serious violence as the anti-globalization marches also took place in Rome, Genoa, Florence, Bologna, Palermo, and a host of other smaller cities across Italy. The largest crowd was in Rome. More than 40,000 people marched along central streets holding banners and led by a number of politicians. In a tribute to the dead protester, the banner that led the demonstration in Rome read, "UG8, us, 5,999,999. The protesters demanded the resignation of the interior minister, a senior figure in the conservative Forza Italia party, led by Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
Unnecessarily mercenary. You're so very unnecessarily mercenary.
Mercenary Baby, Lucky Peterson from his CD Double Dealin' here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives yesterday approved President Bush's Andean Initiative, $676 million in aid for Colombia and six of its neighbors. That's on top of former President Clinton's plan Colombia, $1.3 billion in aid for training and equipping Colombia's military for what the White House calls a war on drugs, but what critics call a war on the people of Colombia. President Bush had also called for a measure that would allow unlimited numbers of U.S. civilians to work under contract in U.S. military operations there. Currently, the U.S. military personnel in Colombia is capped at 500, and the number of civilian contractors capped at 300. Civilian contractors whose missions include flying aircraft into combat areas and a real fumigation of drug crops in rebel-held zones. The House rejected Bush's request, reflecting rising congressional concern of expanded U.S. involvement. But multinational corporations seem to have unlimited access to the country, even if they support paramilitary forces. Labor rights advocates are suing Coca-Cola, the giant U.S.-based beverage company, for the killings and intimidation of union leaders at several of its bottling plants in Colombia. The lawsuit, which was filed Friday in a Miami federal court, charges that Coca-Cola bottling plants brought in right-wing paramilitary death squads to break up unions. Since Coca-Cola is the parent company, it bears responsibility for the abuses they charge, including murder and torture, under both U.S. and state law. The United Steelworkers of America and the International Labor Rights Fund brought the lawsuit on behalf of Sinal Trenal, a Colombian trade union that represents workers in beverage and food companies. The survivors of Isidro Segundo Gil, who was murdered by paramilitary forces inside a bottling plant in 1995, and several other union members who say they've been subjected to the paramilitary's campaign of violence and intimidation. We're going to go down to Colombia in a minute to speak with one of the main officials of the Union of Coke Bottlers. But first to Dan Kovalik, who is with the United Steelworkers of America, a lawyer who's brought the case. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you explain exactly what you're suing Coca-Cola for?
Well, we're suing under the Alien Tort Claims Act, which is a 200-year-old law which allows, as the name suggests, aliens, that is, non-citizens, to sue U.S. entities, people, in this case corporations, for human rights abuses. And it was amended specifically in 1991 to allow for people to bring human rights claims, and that's what we're doing. We're, as you explained correctly, we're alleging that it's several Coke bottling companies in Colombia, four of them to be precise, that the management there engaged in human rights abuses against trade unionists.
Can you talk about who Isidro Segundo Gil is?
Yes, he was a member of the local union executive committee at a Coke bottling plant in Carepa, Colombia. He was actually a member of the successor executive committee that came in after the first one was scared off by paramilitaries. The first executive committee fled Carepa. A second one was elected. He was a member of that. He was subjected, as were the other members of the committee, to threats by both paramilitaries and the management at that facility. The Sinatra, now the union we're representing, brought a national campaign asking for Coca-Cola Colombia, Panamco, which is Coca-Cola's Latin American bottler, and various others to do something to stop what they thought was would be imminent violence on the part of the paramilitaries acting on behalf of the plant manager there. Nothing was done, and his fear, Isidro was murdered within the walls of the plant. And right after he was murdered, paramilitaries were brought into the plant the day after, assembled all the workers, told them they had to resign from the union or be killed. They were brought into the union, the company management office, and given resignation forms, which the company itself had drafted. And they were told to sign those or be killed. And the union members resigned en masse, and the union was destroyed. And the rest of the members of the executive committee fled town at that point.
I should say we tried to get Coca-Cola, a spokesperson, on the line, spoke with them extensively yesterday, but they said they were not prepared to go on, though among their statements they said, "We vigorously deny any wrongdoing regarding human rights violations in Colombia or anywhere else. Wherever we do business around the world, we adhere to the highest standards of ethical conduct and business practices." She said, "We require all of the company's operating units and our suppliers to abide by the laws and regulations of the countries in which they do business, and we expect them to operate with integrity and honesty, two cornerstone values of the Coca-Cola Company. We expect the same of our bottling partners." That the comment of Natalie Rule, spokesperson for the Coca-Cola Company, a statement that was released over the weekend. Your response to that, Dan Kovalik?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, this is not the first time that this has happened at a Coke bottling facility abroad. In Guatemala, there was a bottling company there that murdered three trade union, successive trade unionists in a row. Three they murdered. One was voted, you know, they've killed the union president. Another one was elected. They killed another one. They killed another one. Finally, after massive public pressure, Coke International finally stepped in and stopped it, but only after there was pressure brought to bear. In the case of Colombia, first I would say that to require the plants there to follow the law of that country is cold comfort, given the fact that trade unionists there are fair game for assassination. Out of every five trade unionists killed in the world, over three are Colombian. And while over 3,800 trade unionists have been killed in Colombia since 1986, not one person has been successfully prosecuted for the murder of a trade unionist. So therefore, there's total impunity for this type of violence. And so, you know, limiting it to the law of that country appears to be not very sufficient protection for those people.
Dan Kovalik is a United Steelworkers of America lawyer who's brought the case against Coca-Cola. We're going to go now to Bogota, Colombia, to Javier Correa, who is head of the union the union of Coke bottlers called Senal Trenal. Javier, welcome to Democracy Now.
Bienvenido, Javier.
Welcome, Javier, to Democracy Now.
Javier, bienvenido. ¿Cómo está?
He's being translated by Juan Pablo Lombana, and thanks very much for coming in, Juan Pablo. Can you describe the situation in your plant?
¿Puede usted describir la situación en su planta, en la planta?
A ver, yo soy representante de Senal Trenal, sindicato que tiene presencia en varias embotelladoras de Coca-Cola aquí en Colombia.
Okay, he's a representative.
Igualmente soy trabajador de Coca-Cola en la región de Santander, en la planta de Bucaramanga.
Okay, he's a representative of the union for the plants, and as well he works in the plants that that are located in the region of Santander in Colombia.
And what is happening there? Why do you say Coca-Cola bears responsibility for killings of union workers?
¿Qué es lo que está pasando allá? ¿Por qué dice que Coca-Cola es responsable de la muerte de los sindicalistas?
A ver, primero que todo, nosotros consideramos que hay responsabilidad por acción y por omisión. Para mencionar algún ejemplo, el desarrollo de negociaciones de pliegos de peticiones en Colombia han sido asesinados Oscar Darío Soto el 21 de junio del 2001, un trabajador de Coca-Cola de la planta de Montería.
Okay, un momento. He says that there is a fault for action and omission, that there was a union member who was killed this year. Sí, siga, Javier.
En el año 89, en la embotelladora de Pasto, fue asesinado Abelino Chicanoy, en pleno desarrollo de la negociación de nuestro pliego de peticiones que le habíamos presentado a la embotelladora de Coca-Cola.
Okay, he's giving other names of people who were killed in 89 in other plants. Y en las de ahora, exactamente en las de ahora, ¿por qué hay responsabilidad de Coca-Cola?
A ver, hay un caso que es el de la embotelladora de Carepa. Donde fue el 5 de diciembre del año 96, fue asesinado dentro de la embotelladora Isidro Segundo Gil. Él era secretario general de Senal Trenal y a la vez era el encargado de la negociación del pliego de peticiones que le habíamos presentado a la empresa el 29 de noviembre a las 3 de la tarde.
Okay.
Y nunca quiso negociar.
Okay, he's citing the case of Gil. Of Segundo Gil, who was the secretary general of the union, and he was killed inside the plant and he was the person in charge of the negotiations between the company and the union workers, and he was killed right after the negotiation meeting took place.
Javier, can you explain what Coca-Cola says to you in Colombia?
Javier, ¿puede explicarnos lo que le dice Coca-Cola a usted en Colombia?
A ver, aquí en cada negociación de pliego de peticiones, la empresa de forma permanente ha venido lanzando una serie de calificativos falsos contra los trabajadores que conformamos a Senal Trenal.
Okay, un momento. The first thing is that in each negotiation, the company has, in a continuous way, has been putting out negative commentaries about the union members. Sí, siga.
Siempre refiriéndose a que nuestros pliegos de peticiones están apoyados y que obedecen a organizaciones al margen de la ley.
Okay, always referring to them and their petitions as things that are supported by rebels, or people who are or outlaws. Sí.
So right now, today, what is the situation in the plant that you work in?
Ahora, en la actualidad, ahora, ¿cómo es la situación en la planta en la que usted trabaja?
A ver, para mencionar algunas cosas, en las plantas donde se trabajan, se han aparecido escritos relacionados con grupos paramilitares dentro de las factorías. La empresa nunca ha hecho nada porque la justicia investigue eso, nunca ha denunciado esos casos. Esos escritos incluso amenazan a nuestra organización sindical y también amenazan a algunos dirigentes de nuestro sindicato. La situación es bastante tensa en cuanto a que no podemos adelantar, o en toda protesta que adelantamos, la misma empresa nos trata de penalizar y prohibir por los diferentes mecanismos que tiene internos de que nosotros no ejecutemos el derecho de expresión.
Okay, well, he says that first, there are several, throughout the plant, there are graffitis in the plants, and which are threats to the union members. The situation is very tense. There's all threats around, you know, for a long time, and the company has not paid any attention to those writings on the walls of the plant. And every time that they try to protest, the company tries to penalize these protests.
How endangered are you simply by speaking on the radio?
¿Qué tanto peligro afronta usted, señor Correa, simplemente por hablar en la radio?
No, el peligro es alto. Aquí nosotros, a raíz de la... Por el solo hecho de colocar en conocimiento de la justicia de la Corte Norteamericana este hecho para que sea investigado y se hallen los responsables y para que se aplique justicia, ya los trabajadores en las embotelladoras a partir del día 21 vienen siendo reunidos forzosamente contra su voluntad, aprovechando la empresa que se encuentra en jornadas de trabajo y aprovechando la subordinación laboral, presentándole la misma empresa comunicados, induciéndolos para que los trabajadores los firmen, rechazando la demanda que el sindicato presentó.
Okay, he says that since they have gone with the suit. The company has been getting together the workers and making them sign documents, probably against, you know, for not protesting, asking them not to protest, and that the danger for him is pretty high.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on. We will continue to follow the case of the Coke bottlers in Colombia. Javier Correa, president of Sinal Trinal, the Union of Coke Bottlers, and Dan Kovalik, lawyer with the United Steelworkers of America. If people want to get more information, Dan Kovalik, where can they call or go on the web?
First of all, they can go to the website of the International Labor Rights Fund. I don't have the numbers with me, but if you punch in search International Labor Rights Fund, you'll find it. The complaint that we filed is on that site, and I think it's very useful to people to look at that. If people wish to call me, they can or email me. Why don't I give my email number? It's dkovalik, K-O-V-A-L-I-K, at uswa.org. And I just want to mention that the Steelworkers has been collecting money for a fund to help trade unionists under threat to relocate inside and outside Colombia. And people want to email me to get more information about that, I will be very receptive.
I want to thank you for being with us, and people can get more information at the website webactive.com. com, where Democracy Now! Can be heard every day if you miss any part of it. And also special thanks to Juan Pablo Lombana, who translated for Javier Correa. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to look at U.S. standing alone when it comes to treaties on global warming, on the illicit gun trade, as well as biowarfare. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In Geneva, Bush administration officials announced today the U.S. is rejecting a U.N. treaty that would allow the international community to enforce a ban on biological weapons. The treaty has been under discussion for 7 years. It would allow for international inspections of facilities suspected of producing biological weapons. The U.S. is the only one of 56 countries negotiating in Geneva that's rejected the draft treaty. The announcement in Geneva comes on the heels of the Bush administration's rejection of an international treaty on global warming, as well as the U.S.'s sabotage of an historic U.N. agreement on curbing the international small arms trade. President Bush has repeatedly insisted the U.S. must defend itself against so-called rogue states, an argument that the mass media in this country largely accept. But for much of the world, it's the U.S. that's a rogue state, shredding decades-old arms control treaties and rejecting, sabotaging, or undermining international agreements that enjoy widespread support. We go first to Geneva, to Susana Pimiento. She's with the Sunshine Project, an international group working against biological weapons. Welcome to Democracy Now! Susana, are you there? We go next, then, to Ross Gelbspan, who is a retired journalist and author of The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, and The Prescription. We'll start by looking at the U.S.'s rejection standing in the way of the Global Warming Treaty. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ross.
Hey, Amy. Thank you very
much.
It's
good to have you with us. We'll talk about the latest Bonn Climate Accord talks.
Basically, as you know, the Bush administration turned their backs on it a somewhat naive effort, I think, to hope that they could lure the Bush administration back into the game. The EU actually loosened the rules quite a bit. They allowed, they expanded the loopholes, basically, and so it made for a weaker treaty. And so the treaty itself is really much more of a statement than a real remediation to the problem of global warming. But my sense is, in reading a lot of the quotes that have followed from a lot of the European ministers, there's a very large sea change that people are beginning to feel, which is that the United States is no longer sort of the moral leader, that the United States is no longer an indispensable player, that perhaps the world can move forward without the U.S. And I think that is a very important sort of subtext to what happened in Bonn on the climate talks.
And what are the forces you think played in here to the U.S. Rejecting the Global Warming Treaty?
Well, clearly, the oil and coal industry and their whole campaign of disinformation about climate played into it. Clearly, this Bush-Cheney energy plan, which is really a shortcut to climate hell, basically. And I think their underestimation of how seriously a lot of other countries are taking this issue. I mean, the Europeans see this as a real issue that could threaten the survival of civilization. The science is very clear. Temperatures will be rising by up to 10 or 11 degrees in this current century. We're already seeing ice caps melt and sea levels rise and diseases spread and so forth. I won't go through that whole list of symptoms. But the point is that the rest of the world takes this issue extremely seriously. Bush, I think, did a number of really stupid things. One is that he decided that he would not accept international science in the form of the Intergovernmental Panel of 2,000 scientists who report to the UN. He called for the U.S.'s own National Academy of Science to report on climate change. They said that the international panel is, in fact, underestimating some of the impacts and the magnitudes of what will be coming down the pike. And I think domestically that's going to give a lot of people in this country permission to go ahead and accept the science, whereas they had before been sort of kept on the fence by a lot of the naysayers. I also think another point that Bush made is, well, the way the protocol is written, it exempts the developing countries from the first round of cuts, and Bush said he won't accept anything that doesn't include the participation of the developing countries. And it turns out there was a very timely New York Times article around the time that Bush made that announcement noting that China, whose economy had grown by 36% in the last 4 or 5 years, had cut their emissions by 17% during that period, while the U.S. actually increased its emissions by about 5% with far smaller growth. So a lot of the developing countries are doing what they can, given their resources and so forth, to begin to deal with this issue. And Bush's refusal has also, I think, put this issue in the central spotlight of a lot of activist groups in this country as well as around the world. So I know there's lots of activities beginning that I think will surface and could very well, I think, play a very large part in the 2002 congressional election.
Ross Gelbspan with us, author of The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, and The Prescription, talking about the latest Bonn climate accord that the U.S. has rejected. We're going to try now for Susana Pimiento in Geneva as we do this review of the various U.N. treaties in the last week that the U.S. has rejected or in some way or other tried to sabotage, I think is the probably best way to put it. Susana Pimiento is with the Sunshine Project, a group that works against biological weapons. I guess the question of the day is, why on earth would the U.S. oppose a treaty that would allow for enforcement of a ban on biological weapons?
Thank you. It's a very worrisome position that the U.S. has taken today. It fits in the line of the new administration of unilateralism as opposed to a multilateral solution to the global to the world's problems. Today the U.S. has trashed an effort that it has been going on for more than 6 years. There are several. One is that the U.S. doesn't believe in a multilateral solution. It has appointed itself the global vigilant and using intelligence and using also trade as a way to address the threats of biological weapons, which is completely unacceptable. But there is also another reason, and it's that the U.S. also fears that there are some of the activities that it is currently carrying on fall within the scope of the prohibition of the biological weapons. In other words, the U.S. realizes that that if there is a scrutiny in what it's currently doing, it might get in trouble. And finally, there is also the interest in protecting the industry, the biotech industry supremacy, by hampering exchange of technology particularly to the developing world.
Can you explain more the role of U.S. corporations and the U.S. rejection of the agreement to enforce a ban on biological weapons?
The industry has been arguing that they don't want a system of verification because their secrets will be in danger, hampered. That through the process of verification, there could be some of the trade secrets could be leaked, and they will lose their predominant position. So on the other hand, they don't want to give up a system that is currently in place where there is a strict control on key technology. So definitely this is another case in U.S. policy, foreign policy, which is determined in large part by the industry's interest.
As we go around to the different conferences, I think it's very interesting to see the role the U.S. is playing in each of these cases. We're also joined by Tamara Gabelnik, who is director of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project at the Federation of American Scientists, who's been attending the U.N. Conference on Small Arms Trade at the United Nations here in New York. What was the role of the U.S. In the U.N. Conference on Small Arms Trade, concluded?
Yeah, I would say they were leading the renegade band. And actually let a lot of the so-called rogue nations kind of hide behind their cover. They led the charge to weaken the document throughout, adding qualifying language, really just dissecting this document, which was really only a politically binding document, which means it would have no legal impact on U.S. practice, no changes to U.S. law would be required. And yet it was picked over as if it would have the weight of law. And so that meant every word that could somehow be seen as having some sort of impact on U.S. laws was eliminated. They really, really led the charge against a strong document, which is ironic because in this issue, first of all, the U.S. is impacted as much as any other country. Small arms and light weapons are used not just in conflicts, but by criminals, by drug lords, and the U.S. Receives the brunt of that as much as any other country. And also, ironically, the U.S. Has some of the best export controls on its books. And so it really had an opportunity to play a leadership role here, a positive, constructive leadership role. And instead, it played the exact opposite role.
The U.S. said at the outset it would kill the agreement. Has there been any change in terms of where they're going to go from here, or did they simply dig in their heels?
Well, they didn't kill the agreement. It's a consensus document, and luckily at the very end, the conference did achieve consensus. So we do have a document, which is a very good thing. What happened was that the U.S. laid down certain red lines, which they said could not be crossed, and if any of these paragraphs remained in the text, they would walk away. And they went down to the wire and insisted, and were actually prepared to walk away at the 11th hour, which, the conference could have gone on and they still could have had a document, but without U.S. participation, it really would have been meaningless. So what had to happen was that other countries who had stood on their own principles as strongly as the U.S. did, on issues like including limits or restrictions on civilian ownership of weapons or state transfer of arms to non-state actors, meaning usually insurgents or rebels in other countries, which, of course, a country is going to oppose if they're the ones on the receiving end. Those other countries had to suggest that those paragraphs be deleted to satisfy the U.S. concerns. So the U.S. won.
We only have a minute, but what's international reaction been?
Oh, it's been terrible. I mean, just seeing the faces of the delegates come out afterwards, it was all in their faces. The extreme hostility towards the U.S. and intransigence on this position, it was just like one more time the U.S. has held its line, has been inconsiderate of the consensus view, and has not been willing to compromise. And even the conference chair, somewhat undiplomatically, singled out the U.S. and criticized their position.
And as with the conference where the U.S. stopped the enforcement of the ban on biological weapons on the Bonn global warming talks, what role did U.S. companies play?
Well, the NRA was there in full force, and they were even on the official
National
U.S.
Rifle
delegation,
Association.
Which was very unusual. Any other delegation that had non-governmental members were from the sort of the gun control, the arms control movement. And so they obviously had a privileged position in the delegation and had a very strong influence on the position overall.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us to do that sort of round-robin look at the different UN treaties of the last week that the conferences for which have just concluded on small arms trade, on biological weapons, and on global warming. Susana Pimiento, thanks for being with us from Geneva, the Sunshine Project. Tamara Gamelnik, director of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project at the Federation of American Scientists, and Ross Gelbspan, author of The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, and The Prescription.
Thank you for doing
all
this
of
segment.
Their contact information will be at the website, www.webactive.com. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on the oceans of this country and the Bush administration's approach to them. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Going to the latest issue of Popular Science, a piece by David Helvarg. He begins, "We fly out of Venice, Louisiana, with its floodplain levees, low-lying cow pastures, and oil patch heliports. Our Bell 412 helicopter, a buffed-up version of a Huey, quickly passes over shredding islands of brown spartina, or salt hay, cross-hatched with canals and studded with oil tank transfer stations. We cross the southwest channel of the Mississippi in a surf line the color of chocolate mousse. As we fly beyond the first cluster of oil platforms, the water turns a strange jade green. Soon we're some 50 miles offshore in deep blue water. Everywhere on the horizon are oil platforms. There are 4,000 of these structures in the Gulf of Mexico today. We circle a flat-top platform called Pompano, owned by BP. It's the second tallest bottom-fixed structure in the world, drilling into the floor 1,300 feet below the surface. While President Bush's talk of an energy crisis and plans for increased production of fossil fuels have sparked controversy, few on either side of the debate have paid much attention to the technologically driven boom in oil and gas production taking place in the deep waters of the Gulf. Today, offshore drilling accounts for more than a quarter of U.S. oil and natural gas production, and despite talk of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and in waters off the West Coast, Florida and North Carolina, 93% of offshore production continues to take place in the Gulf. The opening of investigative reporter David Helvarg's article in Popular Science, in which he raises concerns about the failure of U.S. oceans policy to address environmental and social problems. According to environmentalists, it's unlikely the current administration will address those issues either. Last month, President Bush appointed 16 members to a new Oceans Commission, which was created by an act of Congress to reevaluate the government's current ocean and coastal policies. Today, a debate on oil, the ocean industries, and the environment. We're joined by Bob Moran, Director of Government Affairs for the National Ocean Industries Association, and investigative reporter David Helvarg, who's also just published a new book called Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. David Helvarg, let's begin with you. Who is on President Bush's new Oceans Commission?
Well, there are 16 members. The way the law was passed, the American Oceans Act, 12 of them are appointed by the majority in the White House, which is the Republicans. It's pretty much dominated by the offshore oil industry, shipping industry, and the Navy. Who's missing is fishermen, conservation biologists, and ocean activists. It's the first attempt in 30 years, really, to take an overview of the state of America's oceans. And despite the makeup, I'm hopeful there are going to be six public hearings and a chance for the public to participate. 30 years ago, the Stratton Commission, which was the last federal commission to look at our ocean governance, came up with some good things. It resulted in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Marine Sanctuaries Program, Coastal Zone Management. Unfortunately, the main proposal it had, which was putting together the Coast Guard and these other marine agencies and creating an independent agency for ocean exploration protection, was shot down by Richard Nixon. And as a result, we now have half the cabinet and 15 federal agencies and 44 committees and subcommittees of Congress trying to oversee the oceans, often responding to special interests and failing to respond to the natural interactions between our watersheds, coastal waters, and blue ocean. And this new commission is supposed to address those issues and come up with new solutions. I'm just worried it's not broadly enough base to carry that out, although I guess the next 18 months will tell us.
Bob Moran of the National Ocean Industries Association, what do you see as the mission of the Oceans Commission? And how many members of industry, part of your group, are on that commission?
Sure. Well, the mission and the purpose of the Oceans Act, Amy, is articulated in the act that Senator Hollings really pushed through Congress, and it got done, and that's talking about looking at a number of issues on how to bring our ocean policies and then these various segments that were just discussed, stewardship, protection of the marine environment, enhancement of marine commerce, expansion of our scientific understanding of the marine environment, technologies that promote energy, food security, and then also international leadership issues as well, too. So it's a full plate that's before the commission, and they've got 18 months to do that work. When you look at the commission membership as appointed, I don't know if I'd agree with the comments regarding it is not a balanced representation of ocean interests. These people, as we know, are kind of the experts, and they're looking kind of outside the box for new thoughts about how we manage our oceans, what we do to them, and what we get from them.
Who are the two people on the commission from the National Ocean Industries?
Oh, sure. Our two members that are on there are Paul Kelly, and he's with Rowan Industries. Paul has been involved in ocean issues for some time. He was a member of the Oceans Conference that was held and moderated by Vice President Gore. He's served on a number of advisory boards, both for the technological and academic institutions, as well as the federal agencies. The other gentleman who we know well is Mr. Larry Dickerson. He's with Diamond Offshore. Larry was appointed under the Clinton administration to serve on an advisory board to the Department of the Navy regarding its scientific investigations and studies that are going on in the coastal and marine environment.
David Helvarg, can you talk about your concerns about offshore drilling, which is going to be a major issue for the Oceans Commission?
Yeah, let me mention also we have an Alaskan banker on the commission who promotes drilling and a Louisiana professor who sits on a government drilling panel. So that's about four people out of 16. Interestingly, the American Petroleum Institute actively lobbied against the establishment of this commission for two sessions of Congress. It was only last year that Senator Hollings finally got it through. And I think in large measure in response to the Pew Commission, which is a non-governmental commission that's already up and operating and includes two governors, a Republican governor from New York, a Democratic governor from Alaska, as well as Leon Panetta, a former White House chief of staff. It's very high profile, and I wish that this commission were appointed in a little bit more high-profile way. The way this commission was named was it came out on President Bush's website on a Friday evening along with a proposed new ambassador to Zimbabwe and 23 members of a commission to look at the status of White House internships. It's not been given the status it ought to. I hope it will expand. Certainly one of many issues is offshore energy production. As I say, it's fairly amazing. You go out. I went out to a couple of BP platforms, and it's kind of an industrial ballet. You know, the roughnecks and the roustabouts, this mix of men and machinery and technology that's drilling into new depths. In the early 90s, they talked about the Gulf being a dead sea. Now there's 50% increase in production, and over half the production's in depths of 1,000 to 10,000 feet. It's very impressive, but there are two problems. One is, although we're well into this new deep water energy boom, it's only in the last 3 years that they've done any research on what happens when you get a blowout at 5 or 10,000 foot depths. The Deep Spill project, it's a government industry project that spent all of $2.5 million, about 2 days production on one of the platforms I visited. And the conclusions are that Norwegian scientists looked at it, says when you get a blowout at those depths, because of the cold and the pressure, there's not going to be natural gas pushing it up. It's going to form a gel, and you may have the results will be that hours later and miles away from the site of disaster, you'll have oil surface, at which point it'll be too widely spill to be containable. Unfortunately, the history, which I talk about in my book, the history of offshore oil has been going back to the drilling platforms off Summerlin, California in the late 19th century, has been wait for a disaster when you get new technology and then try and figure how to clean it up afterwards. And so for years, the debate has been between producing energy we need and the risk of marine pollution. But now there's a new element, which is simply that we can't afford to keep using fossil fuels, drilling and developing coal and petroleum. And interestingly, BP, that took me out to their platforms, is one of the oil companies that recognizes this. BP was the first energy company. They say they're no longer an oil company, they're an energy company. Their CEO, Mr. Brown, was the first to recognize the science of climate change is real and we're going to have to transition. The BP gentleman I was out there with talked about the need to go from carbon-rich fuels like coal and petroleum to less carbon-rich natural gas and then to carbon-free hydrogen. And so the real shift that has to take place is not only because of the risks of oil spills and pollution, but simply because of the clear science that we're entering a global warming phase to transition out of fossil fuels and into renewables like natural gas, because it's in the same location, because we're drilling it from the same platforms, is a sensible transition fuel. But then we have to move on to biomass, to wind turbines, to photovoltaics, to hydrogen fuel cells. And unfortunately, we now have an administration where the president, his dad, his vice president, his secretary of commerce, who's also in charge of the oceans, they're all out of the Texas oil patch. And I think that by showing a clear preference in their energy plan for increased onshore and offshore production of fossil fuels, they're not only failing to recognize the reality of climate change, where the major impacts are going to be on our coastlines, but they're really undermining America's competitiveness in the world, because the Europeans and others are moving forward with new energy technologies.
Well, let's get the response of Bob Moran of the National Ocean Industries Association on this emphasis on drilling and fossil fuels.
Well, I think getting back to the Oceans Commission, it is not going to be a focus on drilling. You have acts and regulations that are in place. You have a very regulated industry out there, and its history of its environmental operations are impressive. And what we are doing out there with the technology that was mentioned earlier, and the Oceans Commission basically is going to be looking at this technology, which industry is the leader on as far as global observations and the marine predictions, and they'll be looking at that research and how that technology can be used to enhance our understanding of the marine environment. You've got issues like biotechnology. Again, this industry is investing considerable dollars looking at that. Just the increased understanding of the processes involved, be those biological or physical, being able to predict ocean movements much the same as we do with atmospheric modeling. So that's a huge opportunity for the commission, as are some of the international aspects as well, too, such as the Law of the Sea Treaty, supported by our association and others, and unfortunately it hasn't been ratified by the U.S. to date, so the commission will need to look at some of these international aspects of ocean environment and governance as well, too. I doubt that the commission will take time to look at offshore exploration and production, other than possibly looking at the relationship between federal resources and what's being done offshore, both sand and gravel mining and ourselves, as well as fishing and living marine resources well, too, and that relationship with coastal states.
David Helvarg, ultimately, what do you see as the, in looking at your book, Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas, with oceans covering over 71% of the Earth's surface, absorbing far greater amounts of carbon dioxide than rainforests and exerting a powerful control over climate, clouds, and weather. Yet you say the oceans are imperiled as never before. In the closing moments, what now do you feel has to be done, and do you feel there are coalitions in place in the country to accomplish that?
Well, clearly it is in crisis from nutrient runoff, agricultural and urban runoff that's polluting our nearshore waters. Coastal sprawl, 17 of the 20 fastest-growing counties are coastal. We're seeing the collapse of marine wildlife, both from loss of habitat, overfishing for a globalized seafood market. The problems are huge, sea level rise and federal programs that put people in harm's way as we're seeing intensified hurricanes. So the challenges and the risks are tremendous. I do see hope. Both the Pew Commission and the Federal Commission, whatever its makeup, provide opportunities for needed public discussion on the state of our oceans. And I see hope also because this is our last great wilderness frontier. I mean, in 1890, the Census Bureau declared the frontier closed. In 1983, Ronald Reagan declared an exclusive economic zone and extended our controls 200 miles off the shore. That's six times the size of Louisiana Purchase and 30% larger of our terrestrial claims. And it's not every nation that gets a second chance on a new frontier, and the chance is to maintain its this marine wilderness and its health and quality, which gives so much to us. I
mean, let me ask you a quick question. The latest issue of Science magazine, there's an article about more extreme weather coming, more hurricanes, et cetera. We certainly have a lot more weather in the news, yet less understanding about what causes that weather. How does that fit into your analysis?
Well, Chris Lancey, who's a co-author of the studies, predicting that beginning in the early 90s, we've entered a natural 40-year cycle of intensified hurricanes. And you add on top of that the impacts from climate change, up to 3-foot sea level rise and surges during storms, 5 to 10% increased wind shears. The risk is tremendous. Our biggest federal exposure right now is $500 billion of federal flood insurance that the private sector is unwilling to invest in this. And so the feds have come in and provide insurance, which allows the banks to provide the mortgages, which is responsible for the last 30 years of coastal development. Now, there are models. There are models how we can live on or at least near the shore without putting ourselves in harm's way. There are models of how we can reduce nutrients and pollutions. And I talk in the book what I call the Seaweed Rebellion. I mean, it's coastal activists and fishermen and a few developers and a few scientists who are beginning to look at models of how to sustainably live with the sea. We get so much out of it. We really have to return something to it. And the only way that's going to happen is if the 53% of us who live within 50 miles of marine coastline and the rest of us who get all the benefits of seafood and climate and weather being driven by our oceans decide that we have to get politically engaged. It's not enough for a handful of experts or appointed government commissioners to think about the oceans. We all have to think about it, and we all have to consider that it's not too late, that there is a possibility to do better on this new and largely unexplored frontier.
David Helvarg and Bob Moran, thanks for being with us. David Helvarg's latest book, Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas, and Bob Moran, Director of Government Affairs for the National Ocean Industries Association. That does it for today's program. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. It's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by our Brain Trust, Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.